Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, September 10th. You know, on this show, we don't jump on every story in the press about outrageous things that President Trump is alleged to have said. You know the pattern. People report that someone close to Trump says he said this or that. Trump denies it, and mostly people move on. Like, we didn't do a segment last week when The Atlantic reported on anonymous Trump officials alleging that Trump called people who died in World War I suckers and losers. We didn't do a segment on Michael Cohen's new book in which Cohen alleged that Trump is serious about trying to stay in office for more than two terms. There's something every day reported and denied. We try to keep our eye on actions, not tweets, policies, not allegations. But today is different. We were planning a different topic for this segment today, to be honest. But yesterday afternoon, when I heard the Trump tapes recorded by journalist Bob Woodward, I stopped what I was doing, went back and listened to the clips again, and then asked our producer if we could switch this up. By now, most of you know what I'm talking about. Trump told Woodward back on February 7th that the coronavirus was deadlier than the flu, while repeatedly telling the public the opposite. He later admitted to Woodward on tape that he downplayed the threat on purpose. And let's face it, downplaying threats, trying to minimize people's fears, is not what Donald Trump is famous for. Sometimes the best weapon he has is fear itself, and we know he's not afraid to use it. So I'll play the basic clips again now for those of you who haven't heard them yet, or those who still can't believe your ears and are thinking, wait, what? What exactly did he say there? Then I'll play a clip of someone who says her father got the virus and died because he believed Trump's downplaying of it that contradicted the experts. And I'll play a clip of Joe Biden from back in January that the White House is using to excuse the president's duplicity. Spoiler alert, it doesn't. Okay, here we go. Many times the president has said this is like the flu, right? And we don't shut down the economy over the flu. But here's the clip of what he told Bob Woodward in early February. Listen to the end of this in particular, when he calls the virus more deadly than even your strenuous flus.
It goes through air, Bob. That's always tougher than the touch. You know, the touch, you don't have to touch things, right? But the air, you just breathe the air. That's how it's passed. And so that's a very tricky one. That's a very delicate one. It's also more deadly than your, you know, your even your strenuous flus.
So that was February 7th. To use an old Watergate line, what did the president know and when did he know it? That's how early Trump knew that COVID was more deadly than even your strenuous flus, as he put it, February 7th. But he said this to the American people more than a month later. This is from March 10th.
Now, I guess we're at 26 deaths. And if you look at the flu for this year, we're looking at 8,000 deaths and, hundreds of thousands of cases. But we have 8,000 deaths. So you have 8,000 versus 26 deaths at this time.
So that was March 10th. Now I guess we're at 26 deaths, and if you look at the flu, 8,000 deaths, 26 deaths at this time. Then later in March, he spoke to Woodward on tape again and admitted that he was playing down the threat compared to what it actually was.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
Donald Trump to Bob Woodward. It might have been only one street that he was trying to avoid panic on, Wall Street. We could argue he has tried to get the American people to be more afraid than the objective threat about things like immigration or how low-income housing would destroy the suburbs, which he's claiming these days. But was this just one more political spin, or did this one have life and death consequences now that we're at 190,000 deaths? Maybe remember this story that a woman from Arizona told last month at the Democratic Convention.
Hi, I'm Kristen Urquiza. I'm one of the many who has lost a loved one to COVID. My dad, Mark Anthony Urquiza, should be here today, but he isn't. He had faith in Donald Trump. He voted for him, listened to him, believed him and his mouthpieces when they said that coronavirus was under control and going to disappear, that it was okay to end social distancing rules before it was safe, and that if you had no underlying health conditions, you'd probably be fine. So in late May, after the stay-at-home order was lifted in Arizona, my dad went to a karaoke bar with his friends. A few weeks later, he was put on a ventilator. And after 5 agonizing days, he died alone in the ICU with a nurse holding his hand. My dad was a healthy 65-year-old. His only pre-existing condition was trusting Donald Trump, and for that, he paid with his life.
So maybe that's an example of the consequences of Trump strenuously advising people to go back to normal while telling Bob Woodward the coronavirus is more deadly than even your strenuous flus. With me now on this and a few other stories in the news today, if we have time, is Associated Press White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. I'm happy to come out of the bullpen here with the change in topic today. It's always a pleasure.
Jonathan, did Trump know he was being recorded by Bob Woodward during these interviews?
He most certainly did. The president sat for a number of interviews with Bob Woodward, of course, of Watergate fame, who has written books about most presidents that have followed Richard Nixon, and certainly a Washington institution in himself. And I think it's important to just pull back the curtain a little bit here about the backstory as to how this came about. Certainly, these comments appear damaging, and certainly there are questions as to why the president would have participated in interviews that could lead to such damaging remarks being made public. And let's trace back to 2018. Bob Woodward wrote another book about the Trump administration. It was not with the president's participation. In fact, senior aides in the White House decided to keep the interview, Woodward's interview requests from the president. Kellyanne Conway in particular has been on record saying that she did. The White House had just dealt with a series of damaging books, including Michael Wolff's, and they thought there was no upside in participating. Well, the book came out. It had a fairly unflattering portrayal of President Trump, and he was livid, both at the caricature, but also that he wasn't able to be involved. He thought that he could better shape the narrative, shape the story, and would be able to help create a far more flattering and positive depiction of himself. So he said at the time to aides that if Woodward were to write another book, he absolutely would want to participate. There were some in the White House this time around who also objected, but others, like Jared Kushner, were on board. And even if they weren't, the president, some of these interviews were done in late-night phone calls from the White House residence when no aide could have stopped him. The president is someone who holds certain media institutions, and certainly those, his life at times feels like it's sort of still a time capsule from the 1980s. Bob Woodward then, like he is now, was one of the biggest names in journalism. Trump held him in high regard. He wanted to participate. He wanted to get a positive Trump book. But certainly in the excerpts that we've seen so far, that doesn't seem to be the case.
His stated reason for publicly downplaying the threat to not cause panic, you've been covering the White House for the whole Trump administration. Is that consistent with how he usually talks about perceived threats?
No. He often plays up panic. We have seen him just depict the so-called caravan of immigrants heading toward the southern border of the United States just ahead of the 2018 midterms, mind you, as an existential threat to America. We see what he's doing now. The violence that we have seen at times in places like Portland, Oregon, or Kenosha, Wisconsin. He is saying that these are left-wing radicals and anarchists who control Joe Biden, and again, threaten the American way of life. His MO is usually to drum up the panic, drum up the fear, but he perceived this, the coronavirus, as an impending peril to his presidency, to the economy that he was going to, on the back of which he was going to run for re-election, to the stock market, to his chances of another 4 years in office. So certainly, yes, as you say, the White House's party line in the last 24 hours has been the president didn't want to incite panic. He wanted to maintain calm. And he's tweeted to that effect this morning. But here's the question. Is there a difference between trying to maintain calm and being dishonest with the American people? And certainly there are many number of people, not just Democrats, who have suggested in the last 24 hours that President Trump was dishonest with the American people, that he knew more than he was letting on about how lethal this virus was, about how sweeping its impact could be, about how it could rewrite the rules of American society and, frankly, take a lot of lives. And there's real questions today, the questions the White House has to face, that if the president had been more forthright with the American people back in January, February, March, would his administration's response have been different? Would the people's reaction have been different? And could some of these lives have been saved?
We'll see over time if it changes anybody's opinion about anything. I invited Trump supporters to call in and say if it changes anything for you. And here's one, David in Paramus. You're on WNYC. David, we appreciate you stepping in. Hi.
Brian, thanks for taking the time to take my call. And I'm a little bit taken aback by your guest today. He seems to think that you have Trump painted into a corner, that he said things to the famous Watergate author Bob Woodward that maybe he thought wouldn't go out into the public air, which we all know. Obviously, he knew that it would all be played at some point. But why play it today? And what will be played tomorrow? And what will be played over the next 2 months prior to the election? He did this thing that he thought was best. That's why we elected him president. And that was to set a tone and keep the country at ease. He wasn't a fact finder. He's not a scientist. He's going on the best information that he had at the time, that you had, that I had, that we all had, which was, what is the coronavirus and where is it going? And I think for him to err on the side of not causing panic is a much better option than telling the whole country, oh, this is going to be really, really bad. And I'd like to bring up the point with regard to 9/11. I remember, 19 years ago tomorrow, George Bush sitting in that classroom with that look on his face when his aide whispered in his ear that the towers were attacked. George Bush didn't turn around and jump up and, stop the classroom and tell America, run for the covers. It was a moment where he made the best decision with the facts that he had at hand, and he did keep the country from going into a panic. And the comment with regard to panic on the street, Wall Street, I feel it's also not appropriate. Back
well,
to you.
He's done so much to try to calm Wall Street above all else, it seems, economically. But David, let me follow up on the very particular contradiction here, and you tell me if it doesn't bother you, that he's saying, and I understand your point about not wanting to panic people, that part of the president's responsibility is to calm the country in the face of threats. But if he knew more than we knew, you say we all knew the early science, well, he was getting, inside information from the experts and even from the president of China, which was one of his sources for this. If he knew that it was more deadly than the flu, and he turned around and told everybody it's not, so you should go about your normal lives, why isn't that like a doctor who sees that you have a potentially serious heart condition, let's say, and says, but don't do anything different. You don't have to change your diet. You don't have to exercise differently, whatever it is. And that has health consequences for you.
That's an excellent point. I won't say I'm not 100%, fantastically appreciative of what he did on that day. I'm saying that I take with a grain of salt. I don't wake up in the morning and say, well, President Trump said this today, so I'm going to conduct my life, the way that he said to. I feel strongly about, not inciting panic. I think that's a tremendous responsibility. And to the young lady that lost her father, who I send, my condolences to, that spoke at the Democratic National Convention, for Trump to say it's okay to go out for karaoke tonight and don't wear a mask, it just falls flat for me on its face. I've seen Facebook responses from, you know, people that I went to high school with that feel strongly that, you know, this is the most momentous thing that they found that Trump did that was so egregious and so, you know, his responsibility for the 190,000 deaths that have occurred. I don't blame the Trump administration. I wouldn't blame Biden, Roosevelt, or anybody else for an insidious pandemic that struck the world that we've never seen in our lifetimes, you know, any more than I would blame, you know, you or anybody else. I think that we have to go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to, I thought you were wrapping up. And you know what? I'm going to leave it here. I really appreciate you calling in and call us again, okay?
Will do, Brian. Pleasure talking to you. Have a great day.
You too. There is also the Bob Woodward question that's really a parallel to the Donald Trump question. And I'm going to let a listener bring this up and frame the question because, frankly, this is what about half our listeners are calling with. So, Ron in Rockaway Beach, you're going to get to be the spokesperson for a lot of people who have the same question. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you for everything you do. Your show gets me through most days here. Thank and Jonathan, thank you for your excellent journalism. I've seen you standing up and holding, you know, great questions up to Kylie McEnany and to the president, even back as far as Helsinki. My question is, I equate what Bob Woodward has done sort of like what John Bolton has done, and that is, Jonathan, had you known this information back in January and February, and I think thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people have died since then because of this, as a journalist, would you not felt a responsibility to have come forward with this information immediately rather than wait for your book to be published in September in order to make profits?
Well, I'll certainly don't, I won't speak for Bob Woodward beyond relaying what he has said, because that is certainly a question that has come up in the last day or so. Often, just without speaking specifically here, which is starting by, as a matter of course, a lot of interviews done for books are done under the idea of an embargo, right? The material in that interview is going to be saved for the publication of the book rather than for, say, a daily newspaper story. We see that all the time where people will, sometimes even a newspaper reporter will be writing a story, you know, who covers a beat day to day, will do an interview, and some of it might be for that day's story, and then the rest he puts in a file, he or she puts away for use in a book that may not see the light of day for a few months. So I think that's largely how these things work. But you raise a question here because people have wondered about, could if Mr. Woodward had come forward, could lives have been saved had he had perhaps broken this embargo, which we assume he has, although he has not actually said so himself. He spoke to one of my colleagues at Associated Press yesterday and said that he needed to report it out, that it took time for him to verify what the president had said to him. I think we all recognize that President Trump is not always the most reliable narrator, that, you know, that he often, you know, things he will say do not prove to be true, whether he does so intentionally or not. And Woodward has said that he needed time to report out with other sources and double and triple check material in order to feel like it was worth going. Now, it's a matter of timing. That's obviously up to him. But he and The Washington Post have certainly defended his decision and his timing to do his decision to do what he did.
It doesn't sound from his answers to your colleague at the AP and to, I guess, one of his colleagues at The Washington Post that he struggled with it very much. I would think, I would hope that if I were in that position, I would have at least struggled with it. You know, if Woodward had Trump on tape saying something that important to public health on February 7th, like Kristen Urquiza's dad didn't get coronavirus until June because he was listening to Trump. I get saving stuff up for a big picture book, but I just don't know about this one. Woodward is with The Washington Post. Margaret Sullivan, The Washington Post's own media critic, has now written this. The chance, even if it's a slim chance, that those revelations could have saved lives is a powerful argument about against waiting this long. So there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable with, in this case, if revealing Trump's duplicity on this could have changed people's behavior to be more cautious personally. I ask at least why it didn't seem like Woodward was at least conflicted about it at the time and agonizing over it to some degree. Let's take one more Trump supporter. I think Trump supporter. Jordan in Midtown. Jordan, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. I love your show. I listen to it every day. I work in the public policy sphere. My big issue with this, while I think the tapes are somewhat damaging, is that the House Foreign Intelligence Committee, particularly with Adam Schiff, knew about this virus starting in November. While there were plenty of opportunities to raise the alarm, nothing was said. We were pursuing a rogue impeachment that many of us feel was a rogue impeachment. And then moving forward, de Blasio and Pelosi in February were advocating that people would go out, come out to Chinatown, and that's problematic. So, say theoretically, Trump did raise the alarm in February, but you've got people like de Blasio and Pelosi advocating go out. What does that say? Would there have been political consensus then? I think people can act with incomplete information, but they need to have information about that risk conveyed in a way that aligns naturally with how they think. During the height of the pandemic in New York, I went out to Harlem, to the outer boroughs. I surveyed things. I was amazed at how few people were wearing masks and taking the precautions that Governor Cuomo was advocating for. So I don't think the political establishment did a good job of really changing people's behavior in meaningful ways.
Jordan, I want to ask you a follow-up question, but I'm going to play one of the clips that we're hearing a lot in the press today that actually the president is using to help make your case. And they're citing things that, yes, Nancy Pelosi was saying about go eat in Chinatown, Bill de Blasio was saying, even Anthony Fauci was saying at very first, that they didn't think a lot of people in this country were going to die from coronavirus. And here's something that Joe Biden was saying early on that seemed to downplay the threat of coronavirus. This is one that Trump refers to a lot. This is Biden on January 31st after Trump announced his travel ban from China.
This is no time for Donald Trump's record of hysterical xenophobia, and fear-mongering to lead the way instead of science.
Actually, I have to fact check myself. I'm not sure if that was before or after the China travel ban was announced, but certainly Biden was talking about Trump having a xenophobic, meaning afraid of something that's coming from another country, reaction. But Jordan, here's my question, or really, to be honest, my argument about this. Once the science emerged and changed, Cuomo changed his tune, de Blasio changed his tune, Pelosi changed her tune, Trump not so much, apparently for personal interest purposes. Do you disagree?
I do disagree. I think taking science and putting it in one silo and always comparing it to that one point in time is not correct. Science is evolving. It's not an empirical truth. And what we know now,
which is my point, right, that it evolved. And so people saw that it was more serious than they might have first thought.
Sure. But now we know that it's not nearly as deadly as we thought then. So I think vilifying people because they have different perspectives on science is not the solution either.
But you said, just one more quick follow-up. You said now the science tells us it's not as deadly as we thought then. We have 190,000 dead Americans.
Yes, okay. We do. Incredibly. But if we really wanted to control this pandemic, we should have started back in November. And we should have cut off travel altogether from Europe and China.
Jordan, I'm going to leave it there. I appreciate your call. Call us again. I don't think that last answer is really responsive to the question of what we learned after November and December and into March and April, et cetera. But Jonathan Lemire, we're running out of time. Let me give you one more response to anything in the exchanges we've been having.
Well, I think you hit it, Brian, that I think a lot of people, public officials, and public health experts, including Dr. Fauci, understanding of the virus has evolved over time. And I think that there were certainly mistakes made at all levels of government in the early weeks and months of this pandemic because of a lack of knowledge as to what it was and how to handle it. But what I think why the Woodward recordings are resonating like they are is it seems that the president did have more knowledge than he was letting on. And again, I think it's that fine line. There's certainly, yes, he has portrayed himself, his words, as cheerleader in chief sometimes, to be a cheerleader for the country, to keep morale high. That's fair. That's fine. That's part of the job description. But it also does require being honest with the American people. And it seems like he did not, when suggesting, you know, on a phone call with Woodward that he knew that it affected more than just the elderly. And yet days later, in a news conference, the White House suggested children were immune. That to say to Woodward that he knew that could be transmitted through the air and how much more dangerous that was, and then to continue to have large indoor rallies of his own supporters in the following weeks. He had at least five or six in the month of February after he told that to Woodward. That is why his comments are receiving such scrutiny and criticism today. Whether it changes the equation or not for the election does indeed remain to be seen. He is a president who has a remarkable ability to shake off controversy, the remarks that would be damning for anyone else, he seems to glide past. Maybe that will happen here again. Maybe it will not. But certainly I can say this, that his campaign entering the stretch run here, they know they're down to Joe Biden. Not by a lot, but they say they're down. This certainly doesn't help at the very least.
Jonathan Lemire, AP White House correspondent, thanks for coming out of the bullpen, as you put it before, for us. I will say that even though I think you're a Red Sox fan, you are the Mariano Rivera of relief pitchers for this show, and that is the highest praise anyone could give someone coming out of the bullpen. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
I reject that compliment. As a Red Sox fan, I have to reject that compliment. I'm sorry. Though Rivera has my respect. Thank you. Anytime.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.